This is Audible.
Red Seas Under Red Skies by Scott Lynch. Narrated by Michael Page. Copyright 2007 by Scott Lynch. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Bantam Dell, a division of Random House, Inc., and was produced in the year 2009 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Prologue. A Strained Conversation. 1. Loch Lomora stood on the pier in Tal Verar, with the hot wind of a burning ship at his back and the cold bite of a loaded crossbow's bolt at his neck. He grinned and concentrated on holding his own crossbow level with the left eye of his opponent. They were close enough that they would catch most of each other's blood, should they both twitch their fingers at the same time.
"Be reasonable," said the man facing him.
Beads of sweat left visible trails as they slid down his grime-covered cheeks and forehead.
"Consider the disadvantages of your situation."
Locke snorted. "Unless your eyeballs are made of iron, the disadvantage is mutual. Wouldn't you say so, Jean?" They were standing two by two on the pier, Locke beside Jean, their assailants beside one another. Jean and his foe were toe-to-toe with their crossbows similarly poised. Four cold metal bolts were cranked and ready, scant inches away from the heads of four understandably nervous men. Not one of them could miss at this range, not if all the gods above or below the heavens willed it otherwise.
"All four of us would seem to be up to our balls in quicksand," said Jean.
On the water behind them, the old galleon groaned and creaked as the roaring flames consumed it from the inside out. Night was made day for hundreds of yards around. The hull was crisscrossed with the white-orange lines of seams coming apart. Smoke boiled out of those hellish cracks in little black eruptions, the last shuddering breaths of a vast wooden beast dying in agony. The four men stood at the very end of their pier, strangely alone in the midst of light and noise that was drawing the attention of the entire city.
"Lower your piece, for the love of the gods," said Locke's opponent. "We've been instructed not to kill you if we don't have to."
"And I'm sure you'd be honest if it were otherwise, of course," said Locke. His smile grew. "I make it a point never to trust men with weapons at my windpipe. Sorry."
"Your hand will start to shake long before mine does."
"I'll rest the tip of my quarrel against your nose when I get tired. Who sent you after us? What are they paying you? We're not without funds. A happy arrangement could be reached."
"Actually," said Jean, "I know who sent them."
"Really?" Locke flicked a glance at Jean before locking eyes with his adversary once again.
"And an arrangement has been reached, but I wouldn't call it happy."
Jean, I'm afraid you've lost me."
"No."
Jean raised one hand, palm out, to the man opposite him. He then slowly, carefully shifted his aim to his left until his crossbow was pointing at Locke's head. The man he'd previously been threatening blinked in surprise.
"You've lost me, Locke."
"Jean," said Locke, the grin vanishing from his face, "this isn't funny."
"I agree. Hand your piece over to me."
"Jean!"
"Hand it over now, smartly."
"You there, are you some kind of moron? Get that thing out of my face and point it at him."
Jean's former opponent licked his lips nervously, but didn't move. Jean ground his teeth together. "Look, you sponge-witted dock ape, I'm doing your job for you. Point your crossbow at my god's damned partner so he can get off this pier."
"Jean, I would describe this turn of events as less than helpful," said Locke. And he would have said more, except that Jean's opponent chose that moment to take Jean's advice. It seemed to Locke that sweat was now veritably cascading down his face,
as though his own treacherous moisture were abandoning the premises before anything worse happened. There, 3-on-1. Jean spat on the pier and waved toward the two assailants with his free hand. You gave me no choice but to cut a deal with the employer of these gentlemen before we set out. God's damn it, you forced me. I'm sorry. I thought they'd make contact before they drew down on us. Now give your weapon over.
Jean, what the hell do you think you're...
Don't. Don't say another fucking thing. Don't try to finesse me. I know you too well to let you have your say. Silence, Locke. Finger off the trigger and hand it over. Locke stared at the steel-tipped point of Jean's quarrel, his mouth open in disbelief. The world around him seemed to fade to that tiny, gleaming point, alive with the orange reflection of the inferno blazing in the anchorage behind him. Jean would have given him a hand signal if he were lying. Where the hell was the hand signal?
I don't believe this, he whispered. This is impossible.
This is the last time I'm going to say this, Locke. Jean ground his teeth together and held his aim steady, directly between Locke's eyes. Take your finger off the trigger and hand over your God's damned weapon. Right now. Part 1. Cards in the Hand. If you must play, decide upon three things at the start: the rules of the game, the stakes, and the quitting time. Chinese proverb. Chapter 1. Little Games. 1. The game was Carousel Hazard. The stakes were roughly half of all the wealth they commanded in the entire world, and the plain truth was that Locke Lamora and Jean Tannon were getting beaten like a pair of dusty carpets.
"Last offering for the fifth hand," said the velvet-coated attendant from his podium on the other side of the circular table. "Do the gentlemen choose to receive new cards?"
"No, no. The gentlemen choose to confer," said Locke, leaning to his left to place his mouth close to Jean's ear. He lowered his voice to a whisper.
"What's your hand look like?"
"A parched desert," Jean murmured, casually moving his right hand up to cover his mouth. "How's yours?"
"A wasteland of bitter frustration."
"Shit.
Have we been neglecting our prayers this week? Did one of us fart in a temple or something?"
"I thought the expectation of losing was all part of the plan."
"It is. I just expected we'd be able to put up a better fight than this."
The attendant coughed demurely into his left hand, the card table equivalent of slapping Locke and Jean across the backs of their heads. Locke leaned away from Jean, tapped his cards lightly against the lacquered surface of the table, and grinned the best knew-what-he-was-doing sort of grin he could conjure from his facial arsenal. He sighed inwardly, glancing at the sizable pile of wooden markers that was about to make the short journey from the center of the table to his opponent's stacks. "We are, of course, prepared," he said, "to meet our fate with heroic stoicism, worthy of mention by historians and poets." The dealer nodded.
"Ladies and gentlemen, both decline last offering. House calls for final hands?"
There was a flurry of shuffling and discarding as the four players formed their final hands and set them face down on the table before them.
"Very well," said the attendant. "Turn and reveal."
The 60 or 70 of Tal Verar's wealthiest idlers, who had crowded the room behind them to watch every turn of Locke and Jean's unfolding humiliation, now leaned forward as one, eager to see how embarrassed they would be this time. 2. Tal Verar, the Rose of the Gods, at the westernmost edge of what the Therin people call the civilized world. If you could stand in thin air 1,000 yards above Tal Verar's tallest towers, or float in lazy circles there like the nations of gulls that infest the city's crevices and rooftops, you could see how its vast, dark islands have given this place its ancient nickname. They seem to whirl outward from the city's heart, a series of crescents steadily increasing in size like the stylized petals of a rose in an artist's mosaic. They are not natural, in the sense that the mainland looming a few miles to the northeast is natural. The mainland cracks before wind and weather, showing its age. The islands of Tal Varar are unweathered, possibly unweatherable. They are the black glass of the Eldrin, unimaginable quantities of it, endlessly tiered and shot through with passages glazed with layers of stone and dirt from which a city of men and women springs. This rose of the gods is surrounded by an artificial reef, a broken circle 3 miles in diameter, shadows under shadowed waves. Against this hidden wall, the restless sea of brass is gentled for the passage of vessels flying the banners of 100 kingdoms and dominions. Their masts and yards rise in a forest, white with furled sails, far beneath your feet. If you could turn your eye to the city's western island, you would see that its interior surfaces are sheer black walls, plunging hundreds of feet to the softly lapping harbour waves, where a network of wooden docks clings to the base of the cliffs. The seaward side of the island, however, is tiered along its entire length. 6 wide, flat ledges sit one atop the other, with smooth 50-foot escarpments backing all but the highest. The southernmost district of this island is called the Golden Steps. Its 6 levels are thick with alehouses, dicing dens, private clubs, brothels, and fighting pits. The Golden Steps are heralded as the gambling capital of the Therin city-states, a place where men and women may lose money on anything from the mildest vices to the wickedest felonies. The authorities of Tal Varar, in a magnanimous gesture of hospitality, have decreed that no foreigner upon the Golden Steps may be impressed into slavery. As a result, there are few places west of Camor where it is safer for strangers to drink their brains out and fall asleep in the gutters and gardens. There is rigid stratification on the Golden Steps. With each successively higher tier, the quality of the establishments rises, as do the size, number, and vehemence of the guards at the doors. Crowning the Golden Steps are 12 Baroque mansions of old stone and witchwood, embedded in the wet green luxury of manicured gardens and miniature forests. These are the chance houses of quality, exclusive clubs where men and women of funds may gamble in the style to which their letters of credit entitle them. These houses have been informal centres of power for centuries, where nobles, bureaucrats, merchants, ship's captains, legates, and spies gather to wager fortunes, both personal and political. Every possible amenity is contained within these houses. Notable visitors board carriage boxes at exclusive docks at the base of the inner harbour cliffs, and are hauled up by gleaming brass water engines, thereby avoiding the narrow, twisting, crowd-choked ramps leading up the 5 lower steps on their seaward face. There is even a public duelling green, a broad expanse of well-kept grass lying dead centre on the top tier, so that cooler heads need not be given any chance to prevail when someone has their blood up. The houses of quality are sacrosanct. Custom older and firmer than law forbids soldiers or constables to set foot within them, save for response to the most heinous crimes. They are the envy of a continent. No foreign club, however luxurious or exclusive, can quite recapture the particular atmosphere of a genuine Varari chance house. And they are, one and all, put to shame by the Sin Spire. Nearly 150 feet tall, the Sin Spire juts skyward at the southern end of the topmost tier of the steps, which is itself more than 250 feet above the harbour. The Sin Spire is an elderglass tower glimmering with a pearly black sheen. A wide balcony decked with alchemical lanterns circles each of its 9 levels. At night, the Sin Spire is a constellation of lights in scarlet and twilight sky blue, the heraldic colours of Tal Vahr. The Sin Spire is the most exclusive, most notorious, and most heavily guarded chance house in the world, open from sunset to sunrise for those powerful, wealthy, or beautiful enough to make it past the whims of the doorkeepers. Each ascending floor outdoes the one beneath it for luxury, exclusivity, and the risk ceiling of the games allowed. Access to each higher floor must be earned with good credit, amusing behavior, and impeccable play. Some aspirants spend years of their lives and thousands of solari trying to catch the attention of the Sin Spire's master, whose ruthless hold on his unique position has made him the most powerful arbiter of social favor in the city's history. The code of conduct at the Sin Spire is unwritten, but as rigid as that of a religious cult. Most simply, most incontrovertibly, it is death to be caught cheating here. Were the Archon of Tal Vahr himself to be detected with a card up his sleeve, he would find no appeal this side of the gods themselves from the consequences. Every few months, the tower's attendants discover some would-be exception to the rule, and yet another person dies quietly of an alchemical overdose in their carriage, or tragically slips from the balcony 9 stories above the hard, flat stones of the Sin Spire's courtyard. It has taken Locke Lamora and Jean Tannen 2 years and a completely new set of false identities to carefully cheat their way up to the 5th floor. They are, in fact, cheating at this very moment, trying hard to keep up with opponents who have no need to do likewise. 3.
Ladies show a run of spires and a run of sabres, crowned with the sigil of the sun, said the attendant. Gentlemen show a run of chalices and a mixed hand, crowned with the 5 of chalices. 5th hand is to the ladies.
Locke bit the inside of his cheek as a wave of applause rippled through the warm air of the room. The ladies had taken 4 of the 5 hands so far, and the crowd had barely deigned to notice Locke and Jean's sole victory.
"Well, damn!" said Jean, incredible mock surprise.
Locke turned to the opponent on his right. Maracosa Durenna was a slender, dark-complexioned woman in her late 30s, with thick hair the color of oil smoke and several visible scars on her neck and forearms. In her right hand she held a thin black cigar wrapped with gold thread, and on her face she wore a tight smile of detached contentment. The game was clearly not demanding her utmost exertion. The attendant flicked Locke and Jean's little pile of lost wooden counters toward the lady's side of the table with a long-handled crop. He then used the same crop to sweep all the cards back into his hands. It was strictly forbidden for players to touch the cards after the attendant had called for the reveal.
"Well, Madame Durenna," said Locke, "my congratulations on the increasingly robust state of your finances. Your purse would seem to be the only thing growing faster than my impending hangover."
Locke knuckle-walked one of his markers over the fingers of his right hand. The little wooden disc was worth 5 solari, roughly 8 months' pay for a common labourer.
"My condolences on a particularly unfortunate run of cards, Master Costa."
Madame Durenna took a long drag from her cigar, then slowly exhaled a stream of smoke so that it hung in the air between Locke and Jean, just far enough away to avoid direct insult. Locke had come to recognize that she used the cigar smoke as her strapetit, her little game, an ostensibly civilized mannerism actually cultivated to distract or annoy opponents at a gaming table and goad them into mistakes. Jean had planned to use his own cigars for the same purpose, but Durenna's aim was better.
"No run of cards could be considered truly unfortunate in the presence of such a lovely pair of opponents," said Locke.
"I could almost admire a man who can stay so charmingly dishonest while being bled of all his silver," said Durenna's partner, who was seated on Durenna's right, between her and the dealer.
Ismila Corvalour was nearly of a size with Jean, wide and florid, prodigiously rounded in every place a woman could be round. She was undeniably attractive, but the intelligence that shone out of her eyes was sharp and contemptuous. In her, Locke recognized a contained pugnacity akin to that of a street brawler, a honed appetite for hard contests. Corvalour nibbled constantly from a silver-gilded box of cherries coated in powdered chocolate, sucking her fingers loudly after each one. Her own Stra Petit, of course. She was purpose-built for carousel hazard, thought Locke. A mind for the cards and a frame capable of withstanding the game's unique punishment for losing a hand.
"Default," said the attendant.
Within his podium he tripped the mechanism that set the carousel spinning. This device, in the center of the table, was a set of circular brass frames that held row upon row of tiny glass vials, each one capped in silver. It whirled under the soft lantern light of the gaming parlor, until it became continuous streaks of silver within brass, and then a clinking sound of mechanisms beneath the table, the rattle of many tiny vessels of thick glass colliding with one another, and the carousel spat out two of its vials. They rolled toward Locke and Jean and clattered against the slightly upraised outer rim of the table. Carousel Hazard was a game for two teams of two. An expensive game, for the clockwork carousel mechanism came very dear. At the end of each hand, the losing team was randomly dispensed two vials from the carousel's great store of little bottles. These held liquor, mixed with sweet oils and fruit juice to disguise the potency of any given drink. The cards were only one aspect of the game. Players also had to maintain concentration under the increasing effects of the devilish little vials. The only way a game could end was for a player to become too drunk to keep playing. Theoretically, the game could not be cheated. The Sinspire maintained the mechanism and prepared the vials. The little silver caps were fastened tight over wax seals. Players were not permitted to touch the carousel or another player's vials on pain of immediate default. Even the chocolates and cigars being consumed by the players had to be provided by the house. Locke and Jean could even have refused to allow Madame Corvalour the luxury of her sweets, but that would have been a bad idea for several reasons.
"Well," said Jean, as he cracked the seal on his tiny libation, "here's to charming losers, I suppose."
"If only we knew where to find some," said Locke.
And in unison they tossed back their drinks. Locke's left a warm, plum-flavored trail down his throat. It was one of the potent ones. He sighed and set the empty vial down before him. Four vials to one, and the way his concentration seemed to be unraveling at the edges meant that he was beginning to feel it. As the attendant sorted and shuffled the cards for the next hand, Madame de Renna took another long, satisfied draw on her cigar and flicked the ashes into a solid gold pot set on a pedestal behind her right hand. She exhaled two lazy streams of smoke through her nose and stared at the carousel from behind a grey veil. De Renna was a natural ambush predator, Locke thought, always most comfortable behind some camouflage. His information said that she was only recently arrived in the life of a city-bound merchant speculator. Her previous profession had been the command of bounty privateers, hunting and sinking the slaver ships of Jerem on the high seas. She hadn't acquired those scars drinking tea in anyone's parlour. It would be very, very unfortunate if a woman like her were to realize that Locke and Jean were counting on what Locke liked to call discreetly unorthodox methods to win the game. Hell, it would be preferable to simply lose the old-fashioned way or to be caught cheating by the Sinspire attendants. They, at least, would probably be quick and efficient executioners. They had a very busy establishment to run.
"Hold the cards," said Madame Corvalour to the attendant, interrupting Locke's musings. "Mara, the gentlemen have indeed had several hands of unfortunate luck. Might we not allow them a recess?"
Locke concealed his instant excitement. The pair of Carousel Hazard partners that held the lead could offer their opponents a short break from the game, but the courtesy was rarely extended, for the obvious reason that it allowed the losers precious time to shake the effects of their liquor. Was Corvalur trying to cover for some distress of her own?
"The gentlemen have seen a great deal of strenuous effort on our behalf, counting all those markers and pushing them over to us again and again."
Durenna drew smoke, expelled it.
"You would honour us, gentlemen, if you would consent to a short pause to refresh and recover yourselves."
"Ah." Locke smiled and folded his hands on the table before him. So that was the game. Play to the crowd and show off how little regard the ladies truly had for their opponents, how inevitable they considered their own victory. This was etiquette fencing, and Durenna had performed the equivalent of a lunge for the throat. Outright refusal would be terrible form. Locke and Jean's parry would have to be delicate.
"How could anything be more refreshing," said Jean, "than to continue our game against such an excellent partnership?"
"You're too kind, Master de Ferrer," said Madame de Renna. "But would you have it said that we were heartless? You've refused us neither of our comforts."
She used her cigar to gesture at Madame Corvalur's sweets.
"Would you refuse us our desire to give a comfort in exchange?"
"We would refuse you nothing, madam. And yet we would beg leave to answer your greater desire, for which you've troubled yourselves to come here tonight, the desire to play."
"There are many hands yet before us," added Locke, "and it would wound Jerome and myself to inconvenience the ladies in any way."
He made eye contact with the dealer as he spoke.
"You have thus far presented no inconvenience," said Madame Corvalur sweetly.
Locke was uncomfortably aware that the attention of the crowd was indeed hanging on this exchange. He and Jean had challenged the two women widely regarded as the best Carousel Hazard players in Tal Verar, and a substantial audience had packed all the other tables on the fifth floor of the Sinspire. Those tables should have been hosting games of their own, but by some unspoken understanding between the house and its patrons, other action in the parlour had ceased for the duration of the slaughter.
"Very well," said Durenna. "We've no objection to continuing, for our sakes. Perhaps your luck may even turn."
Locke's relief that she had abandoned her conversational ploy was faint. She did, after all, have every expectation of continuing to thrash money out of him and Jean, like a cook might beat weevils from a bag of flour.
"Sixth hand," said the attendant. "Initial wager will be 10 solari.
As each player pushed forward 2 wooden coins, the attendant tossed 3 cards down in front of them. Madame Corvalur finished another chocolate-dusted cherry and sucked the sweet residue from her fingers. Before touching his cards, Jean slid the fingers of his left hand briefly under the lapel of his coat and moved them as though scratching an itch. After a few seconds, Locke did the same. Locke caught Madame de Renna watching them and saw her roll her eyes. Signals between players were perfectly acceptable, but a bit more subtlety was preferred. Durenna, Locke, and Jean peeked at their cards almost simultaneously. Corvalur was a moment behind them, with her fingers still wet. She laughed quietly. Genuine good fortune or strapetit? Durenna looked eminently satisfied, but Locke had no doubt she maintained that precise expression even in her sleep. Jean's face revealed nothing, and Locke, for his part, tried on a thin smirk, although his 3 opening cards were pure trash. Across the room, a curving set of brass-railed stairs, with a large attendant guarding their foot, led up toward the 6th floor, briefly expanding into a sort of gallery on the way. A flicker of movement from this gallery caught Locke's attention. Half-concealed in shadow was a slight, well-dressed figure. The warm golden light of the room's lanterns was reflected in a pair of optics, and Locke felt a shivery thrill of excitement along his spine.
Could it be?
Locke tried to keep one eye on the shadowy figure while pretending to fixate on his cards. The glare on those optics didn't waver or shift. The man was staring at their table, all right. At last, he and Jean had attracted, or stumbled into, and by the gods they'd take that bit of luck, the attention of the man who kept his offices on the 9th floor, master of the Sinspire, clandestine ruler of all Talvarar's thieves, a man with an iron grip on the worlds of larceny and luxury both. In Camor they would have called him Kappa, but here he affected no title save his own name. Requin. Locke cleared his throat, turned his eyes back to the table, and prepared to lose another hand with grace. Out on the dark water, the soft echo of ship's bells could be heard, ringing the 10th hour of the evening. 4.
18th hand, said the dealer. Initial wager will be 10 solari.
Locke had to push aside the 11 little vials before him with a visibly shaking hand to slide his buy-in forward. Madame Durenna, steady as a dry-docked ship, was working on her 4th cigar of the night. Madame Corvalier seemed to be wavering in her seat. Was she perhaps more red-cheeked than usual? Locke tried not to stare too intently as she placed her initial wager. Perhaps the waver came solely from his own impending inebriation. It was nearing midnight, and the smoke-laced air of the stuffy room scratched at Locke's eyes and throat like wool. The dealer, emotionless and alert as ever, he seemed to have more clockwork in him than the carousel did, flicked 3 cards to the tabletop before Locke. Locke ran his fingers under his coat lapel, then peeked at his cards and said, "Aha," with a tone of interested pleasure. They were an astonishing constellation of crap. His worst hand yet. Locke blinked and squinted, wondering if the alcohol was somehow masking a set of decent cards, but alas, when he concentrated again, they were still worthless. The ladies had been forced to drink last, but unless Jean concealed a major miracle on the tabletop to Locke's left, it was a good bet that another little vial would soon be rolling merrily across the table toward Locke's wobbling hand. 18 hands, thought Locke, to lose 980 solari thus far. His mind, well wet by the Sinspire's liquor, wandered off on its own calculations. A year of fine new clothes for a man of high station, a small ship, a very large house, the complete lifetime earnings of an honest artisan like a stonemason. Had he ever pretended to be a stonemason?
1st options, said the dealer, snapping him back to the game.
Card, said Jean. The attendant slid one to him. Jean peeked at it, nodded, and slid another wooden chit toward the center of the table. Bid up.
Hold fast, said Madame Durenna. She moved 2 wooden chits forward from her substantial pile. Partner reveal.
She showed 2 cards from her hand to Madame Corvalier, who was unable to contain a smile.
Card, said Locke. The attendant passed him one, and he turned up an edge just far enough to see what it was.
The 2 of chalices, worth precisely 1 wet shit from a sick dog in this situation. He forced himself to smile.
Bid up, he said, sliding 2 markers forward. I'm feeling blessed.
All eyes turned expectantly to Madame Corvalier, who plucked a chocolate-dusted cherry from her dwindling supply, popped it into her mouth, and then rapidly sucked her fingers clean.
Oh-ho, she said, staring down at her cards and drumming 1 set of sticky fingers gently on the table. Oh-ho, oh, Mara, this is the oddest.
And then she slumped forward, settling her head onto her large pile of wooden markers on the tabletop. Her cards fluttered down face up, and she slapped at them without coordination, trying to cover them up.
Ismila, said Madame Durenna, a note of urgency in her voice. Ismila!
She reached over and shook her partner by her heavy shoulders.
"Zwila,"
Madame Corvalet agreed in a sleepy, blubbering voice. Her mouth lolled open, and she drooled remnants of chocolate and cherry onto her 5 solari chits.
"Mila, very odd, oddest. Play sits with Madame Corvalet."
The dealer couldn't keep his surprise out of his voice.
"Madame Corvalet must state a preference."
"Ismila, concentrate!"
Madame Durenna spoke in an urgent whisper.
"There are cards,"
mumbled Corvalet.
"Look out, Mara, so many cards on table."
She followed that up with,
"Blemble na flaga."
And then she was out cold.
"Final default,"
said the dealer after a few seconds. With his crop, he swept all of Madame Durenna's markers away from her, counting rapidly. Locke and Jean would take everything on the table. The looming threat of 1,000 solari loss had just become a gain of equal magnitude, and Locke sighed with relief. The dealer considered the spectacle of Madame Corvalet using her wooden markers as a pillow, and he coughed into his hand.
"Gentlemen," he said, "the house will, provide new chits of the appropriate value in place of those still in use."
"Of course," said Jean, gently patting the little mountain of Durenna's markers suddenly piled up before him. In the crowd behind them, Locke could hear noises of bewilderment, consternation, and surprise. A light ripple of applause was eventually coaxed into existence by some of the more generous observers, but it died quickly. They were faintly embarrassed, rather than exhilarated, to see a notable like Madame Corvalet inebriated by a mere 6 drinks. said Madame Durenna, stubbing out her cigar in the gold pot and rising to her feet. She made a show of straightening her jacket. Black brocaded velvet decorated with platinum buttons and cloth of silver, worth a good fraction of everything she'd bet that night.
"Master Costa, Master de Ferra, it appears we must admit to being outmatched."
"But certainly not outplayed," said Locke, summoning up a snake-charming smile along with the pulverized remnants of his wits. "You very nearly had us, sewn up."
"And the whole world is wobbling around me," said Jean, whose hands were as steady as a jeweler's and had been throughout the entire game.
"Gentlemen, I have appreciated your stimulating company," said Madame Durenna in a tone of voice that indicated she hadn't. "Another game later this week, perhaps? Surely you must allow us a chance at revenge, for honour's sake."
"Nothing would please us more," said Jean,
to which Locke nodded enthusiastically, making the contents of his skull ache. At that, Madame Durenna coldly held out her hand and consented for the two of them to kiss the air above it. When they had done so, as though making obeisance to a particularly irritable snake, 4 of Requin's attendants appeared to help move the snoring Madame Corvalet somewhere more decorous.
"Gods, it must be tedious watching us try to drink one another under the table night after night," said Jean.
He flipped the dealer a 5 solari chit. It was customary to leave a small gratuity for the attendant.
"I don't believe so, sir. How would you like your change?"
"What change?" Jean smiled. "Keep the whole thing."
The attendant betrayed human emotions for the 2nd time that night. Relatively well off as he was, 1 little wooden chit was half his annual salary. He stifled a gasp when Locke threw him another dozen.
"Fortune is a lady who likes to be passed around," said Locke. "Buy a house, maybe. I'm having a little trouble counting at the moment."
"Sweet gods! Many thanks, gentlemen."
The attendant took a quick glance around, and then spoke under his breath.
"Those 2 ladies don't lose very often, you know. In fact,
This is the first time I can remember.
Victory has its price, said Locke. I suspect my head will be paying it when I wake up tomorrow.
Madame Corvalier was hauled carefully down the stairs, with Madame Durenna following to keep a close eye on the men carrying her card partner. The crowd dispersed. Those observers who remained at their tables called for attendance, food, new decks of cards for games of their own. Locke and Jean gathered their markers, fresh ones, sans slobber, were swiftly provided by the attendants to replace Madame Corvalier's, in the customary velvet-lined wooden boxes, and made their way to the stairs.
"Congratulations, gentlemen," said the attendant guarding the way up to the sixth floor. The tinkle of glass on glass and the murmur of conversation could be heard filtering down from above.
"Thank you," said Locke. "I'm afraid that something in Madame Corvalier gave way just a hand or two before I might have done the same."
He and Jean slowly made their way down the stairs that curved all the way around the inside of the Sinspire's exterior wall. They were dressed as men of credit and consequence in the current height of Ferrari summer fashion. Locke, whose hair had been alchemically shifted to a sunny shade of blonde, wore a caramel-brown coat with a cinched waist and flaring knee-length tails. His huge triple-layered cuffs were panelled in orange and black, and decorated with gold buttons. He wore no waistcoat, just a sweat-soaked tunic of the finest silk under a loose black neckcloth. Jean was dressed similarly, though his coat was the greyish-blue of a sea under clouds, and his belly was cinched up with a wide black sash, the same colour as the short curly hairs of his beard. Down past floors of notables they went, past queens of Ferrari commerce with their decorative young companions of both sexes on their arms like pets, past men and women with purchased Lashani titles, staring across cards and wine decanters at lesser dons and donyas from Camorre, past Vadran shipmasters in tight black coats, with sea tans like masks over their sharp, pale features. Locke recognized at least two members of the Priori, the merchant council that theoretically ruled Tal Verar. Deep pockets seemed to be the primary qualification for membership. Dice fell and glasses clinked. Celebrants laughed and coughed and cursed and sighed. Currents of smoke moved languidly in the warm air, carrying scents of perfume and wine, sweat and roast meats, and here and there the resiny hint of alchemical drugs. Locke had seen genuine palaces and mansions before. The Sinspire, opulent as it was not so very much more handsome than the homes many of these people would be returning to when they finally ran out of night to play in. The real magic of the Sinspire was woven from its capricious exclusivity. Deny something to enough people, and sooner or later it will grow a mystique as thick as fog. Nearly hidden at the rear of the first floor was a heavy wooden booth manned by several unusually large attendants. Luckily, there was no line. Locke set his box down on the countertop beneath the booth's only window, a bit too forcefully.
"All to my account."
"My pleasure, Master Costa,"
said the chief attendant as he took the box. Leocanto Costa, merchant speculator of Talisham, was well known in this kingdom of wine fumes and wagers. The attendant swiftly changed Locke's pile of wooden chits into a few marks on a ledger. In beating Durenna and Corvalier, even minus his tip to the dealer, Locke's cut of the winnings came to nearly 500 solari.
"I understand that congratulations are in order to the both of you, Master de Ferra," said the attendant as Locke stepped back to let Jean approach the counter with his own box. Jerome de Ferra, also of Talisham, was Leocanto's boon companion. They were a pair of fictional peas in a pod.
Suddenly, Locke felt a hand fall onto his left shoulder. He turned warily and found himself facing a woman with curly dark hair, richly dressed in the same colours as the Sinspire attendants. One side of her face was sublimely beautiful. The other side was a leathery brown half-mask, wrinkled, as though it had been badly burned. When she smiled, the damaged side of her lips failed to move.
It seemed to Locke as though a living woman was somehow struggling to emerge from within a rough clay sculpture. Selendri, Requin's majordomo. The hand that she had placed on his shoulder, her left on the burned side, wasn't real. It was a solid brass simulacrum, and it gleamed dully in the lantern light as she withdrew it.
"The house congratulates you,"
she said in her eerie, lisping voice,
"for good manners as well as considerable fortitude, and wishes you and Master de Ferre to know that you would both be welcome on the sixth floor, should you choose to exercise the privilege."
Locke's smile was quite genuine.
"Many thanks, on behalf of myself and my partner," he said with tipsy glibness. "The kind regard of the house is, of course, extremely flattering."
She nodded noncommittally, then slipped away into the crowd as quickly as she'd come. Eyebrows went up appreciatively here and there. Few of Requin's guests, to Locke's knowledge, were apprised of their increasing social status by Selendri herself.
"We're a commodity in demand, my dear Jerome," he said, as they made their way through the crowd toward the front doors.
"For the time being," said Jean.
"Master de Ferre," beamed the head doorman as they approached, "and Master Costa, may I call for a carriage?"
"No need, thanks," said Locke. "I'll fall over sideways if I don't flush my head with some night air. We'll walk."
"Very good then, sir."
With military precision, four attendants held the doors open for Locke and Jean to pass. The two thieves stepped carefully down a wide set of stone steps covered with a red velvet carpet. That carpet was thrown out and replaced each night. As a result, in Tal Vara alone could one find armies of beggars routinely sleeping on piles of red velvet scraps. The view was breathtaking. To their right, the whole crescent sweep of the island was visible beyond the silhouettes of other chance houses. There was relative darkness in the north, in contrast to the aura-like glow of the golden steps. Beyond the city, to the south, west, and north, the sea of brass gleamed phosphorescent silver, lit by three moons in a cloudless sky. Here and there the sails of distant ships reached up from the quicksilver tableau, ghostly pale. Locke could gaze downward to his left and see across the staggered rooftops of the island's five lower tiers, a vertigo-inducing view despite the solidity of the stones beneath his feet. All around him was the murmur of human pleasure and the clatter of horse-drawn carriages on cobbles. There were at least a dozen moving or waiting along the straight avenue atop the sixth tier. Above, the Sinspire reared up into the opalescent darkness with its alchemical lanterns bright, like a candle meant to draw the attentions of the gods.
"And now, my dear professional pessimist," said Locke as they stepped away from the Sinspire and acquired relative privacy, "my worry merchant, my tireless font of doubt and derision, what do you have to say to that?"
"Oh, very little, to be sure, Master Costa. It's so hard to think, overawed as I am with the sublime genius of your plan."
"That bears some vague resemblance to sarcasm."
"Gods forfend," said Jean. "You wound me. Your inexpressible criminal virtues have triumphed again, as inevitably as the tides come and go. I cast myself at your feet and beg for absolution. Yours is the genius that nourishes the heart of the world.
And now you're..."
"If only there was a leper handy," interrupted Jean, "so you could lay your hands on and magically heal him."
"Oh, you're just farting out your mouth because you're jealous."
"It's possible," said Jean. "Actually, we are substantially enriched. Not caught, not dead, more famous, and welcome on the next floor up. I must admit that I was wrong to call it a silly scheme."
"Really? Huh."
Locke reached under his coat lapels as he spoke.
"Because I have to admit, it was a silly scheme. Damned irresponsible. One drink more and I would have been finished.
I'm actually pretty bloody surprised we pulled it off."
He fumbled beneath his coat for a second or two, then pulled out a little pad of wool about as wide and long as his thumb. A puff of dust was shaken from the wool when Locke slipped it into one of his outer pockets, and he wiped his hands vigorously on his sleeves as they walked along.
"Nearly lost is just another way to say finally won," said Jean. "Nonetheless, the liquor almost did me in. Next time I'm that optimistic about my own capacity, correct me with a hatchet to the skull."
"I'd be glad to correct you with two."
It was Madame Ismila Corvalur who had made the scheme possible. Madame Corvalur, who'd first crossed paths with Leocanto Costa at a gaming table a few weeks earlier, who had the reliable habit of eating with her fingers to annoy her opponents while she played cards. Carousel Hazard really couldn't be cheated by any traditional means. None of Requin's attendants would stack a deck, not once in 100 years, not even in exchange for a dukedom. Nor could any player alter the carousel, select one vial in favour of another, or serve a vial to anyone else. With all the usual means of introducing a foreign substance to another player guarded against, the only remaining possibility was for a player to do herself in by slowly, willingly taking in something subtle and unorthodox, something delivered by a means beyond the ken of even a healthy paranoia. Like a narcotic powder, dusted on the playing cards in minute quantities by Locke and Jean, then gradually passed around the table to a woman continually licking her fingers as she played. Bella Paranella was a colourless, tasteless alchemical powder, also known as the Night Friend. It was popular with rich people of a nervous disposition, who took it to ease themselves into deep, restful slumber. When mixed with alcohol, Bella Paranella was rapidly effective in tiny quantities. The two substances were as complementary as fire and dry parchment. It would have been widely used for criminal purposes if not for the fact that it sold for 20 times its own weight in white iron.
"Gods, that woman had the constitution of a war galley," said Locke. "She must have started getting some of the powder by the third or fourth hand. Probably could have killed a pair of wild boars in heat with less."
"At least we got what we wanted," said Jean, removing his own powder reservoir from his coat. He considered it for a moment, shrugged, and slipped it in a pocket.
"We did indeed, and I saw him," said Locke. "Requin, he was on the stairs, watching us for most of the hands in the middle game. We must have excited a personal interest."
The exciting ramifications of this helped clear some of the haze from Locke's thoughts. Why else send Selendri herself to pat our backs?
"Well, assume you're correct. So what now? Do you want to push on with it, like you mentioned, or do you want to take it slow? Maybe gamble around on the 5th and 6th floors for a few more weeks?"
"A few more weeks? To hell with that. We've been kicking around this goddamned city for 2 years now. If we finally cracked Requin's shell, I say we bloody well go for it."
"You're going to suggest tomorrow night, aren't you?"
"His curiosity's piqued. Let's strike while the blade is fresh from the forge."
"I suspect that drink has made you impulsive."
"Drink makes me see funny. The gods make me impulsive."
"You there," came a voice from the street in front of them. "Hold it."
Locke tensed.
"I beg your pardon?"
A young, harried-looking Ferrari man with long black hair was holding his hands out, palms facing toward Locke and Jean. A small, well-dressed crowd seemed to have gathered beside him, at the edge of a trim lawn that Locke recognized as the dueling green.
"Hold it, sirs, I beg of you," said the young man. "I'm afraid it's an affair, and there may be a bolt flying past. Might I beg of you to wait but a moment?"
"Oh!"
Locke and Jean relaxed simultaneously. If someone was dueling with crossbows, it was common courtesy as well as good sense to wait beside the dueling ground until the shots were taken. That way neither participant would be distracted by movement in the background or accidentally bury a bolt in a passer-by. The dueling green was about 40 yards long and half as wide,
lit at each of its four corners by a soft white lantern hanging in a black iron frame. Two duelists stood in the center of the green with their seconds, each man casting four pale grey shadows in a criss-cross pattern. Locke had little personal inclination to watch, but he reminded himself that he was supposed to be Leocanto Costa, a man of worldly indifference to strangers punching holes in one another. He and Jean squeezed into the crowd of spectators as unobtrusively as possible. A similar crowd had formed on the other side of the green. One of the duelists was a very young man, dressed in fine, loose gentleman's clothing of a fashionable cut. He wore optics, and his hair hung to his shoulders in well-tended ringlets. His red-jacketed opponent was a great deal older, a bit hunched over and weathered. He looked active and determined enough to pose a threat, however. Each man held a lightweight crossbow, what Camorri thieves would call an alley piece. "Gentlemen," said the younger duelist's second, "please, can there be no accommodation? If the Lashani gentleman will withdraw his imprecation," added the younger duelist, his voice was high and nervous, "I would be eminently satisfied with the merest recognition."
"No, there cannot," said the man standing beside the older duelist. "His lordship is not in the habit of tendering apologies for mere statements of obvious fact."
"With the merest recognition," continued the young duelist desperately, "that the incident was an unfortunate misunderstanding, and that it need not—"
"Were he to condescend to speak to you again," said the older duelist second, "his lordship would no doubt also note that you wail like a bitch, and would inquire as to whether you're really capable of biting like one."
The younger duelist stood speechless for a few seconds, then gestured rudely toward the older men with his free hand.
"I am forced," said his second, "I am, forced to allow that there may be no accommodation. Let the gentlemen stand back to back."
The two opponents walked toward each other. The older man marched with vigor while the younger still stepped hesitantly and turned their backs to each other.
"You shall have 10 paces, said the younger man's second, with bitter resignation. "Wait, then, and on my signal you may turn and loose."
Slowly he counted out the steps. Slowly the two opponents walked away from each other. The younger man was shaking very badly indeed. Locke felt a ball of unaccustomed tension growing in his own stomach. Since when had he become such a damned soft-hearted fellow? Just because he preferred not to watch didn't mean he should be afraid to do so. Yet the feeling in his stomach paid no heed to the thoughts in his head.
9, 10. Stand fast," said the young duelist second. "Stand fast. Turn and loose."
The younger man whirled first, his face a mask of terror. He threw out his right hand and let fly. A sharp twang sounded across the green. His opponent didn't even jerk back as the bolt hissed through the air beside his head, missing by at least the width of a hand. The red-jacketed old man completed his own turn more slowly, his eyes bright and his mouth set into a scowl. His younger opponent stared at him for several seconds, as though trying to will his bolt to come flying back like a trained bird. He shuddered, lowered his crossbow, and then threw it down to the grass. With his hands on his hips, he stood waiting, breathing in deep and noisy gulps. His opponent regarded him briefly, then snorted.
"Be fucked," he said,
and he raised his crossbow in both hands. His shot was perfect. There was a wet crack, and the younger duelist toppled with a feathered bolt dead in the center of his chest. He fell onto his back, clawing at his coat and tunic, spitting up dark blood. Half a dozen spectators rushed toward him, while one young woman in a silver evening gown fell to her knees and screamed.
"We'll get back just in time for dinner,"
said the older duelist to nobody in particular. He tossed his own crossbow carelessly to the ground behind him and stomped off toward one of the nearby chance houses, with his second at his side. "Sweet fucking Perelandro," said Locke, forgetting Leocanto Costa for a moment and thinking out loud. What a way to manage things!
You don't approve, sir?
A lovely young woman in a black silk dress regarded Locke with disconcertingly penetrating eyes. She couldn't have been more than 18 or 19.
I understand that some differences of opinion need to be settled with steel, said Jean, butting in, appearing to recognize that Locke was still a bit too tipsy for his own good. But standing before a crossbow bolt seems foolish. Blades strike me as a more honest test of skills.
Rapiers are tedious, all that back and forth, and rarely a killing strike right away, said the young woman. Bolts are fast, clean, and merciful. You can hack at someone all night with a rapier and fail to kill them.
I am quite compelled to agree with you, muttered Locke.
The woman raised an eyebrow but said nothing. A moment later she was gone, vanishing into the dispersing crowd. The contented murmur of the night, the laughter and chatter of the small clusters of men and women making time beneath the stars, had died briefly while the duel took place, but now it rose up once again. The woman in the silver dress beat her fists against the grass, sobbing, while the crowd around the fallen duelist seemed to sag in unison. The bolt's work was clearly done.
"Fast, clean, and merciful," said Locke softly. "Idiots!" Jean sighed. "Neither of us has any right to offer that sort of observation, since God's damned idiots is likely to be inscribed on our grave markers. I've had reasons for doing what I've done, and so did you."
I'm sure those duelists felt the same way.
"Let's get the hell out of here," said Locke. "Let's walk off the fumes in my head and get back to the inn. Gods, I feel old and sour. I see things like this, and I wonder if I was that bloody stupid when I was that boy's age."
"You were worse," said Jean, "until quite recently. Probably still are."
5. Locke's melancholy slowly evaporated, along with more of his alcoholic haze, as they made their way down and across the golden steps, north by northeast, to the great gallery. The Eldrin craftsmen, craftswomen, craftsthings, responsible for Tal Varrar, had covered the entire district with an open-sided elderglass roof that sloped downward from its peak atop the sixth tier and plunged into the sea at the western island's base, leaving at least 30 feet of space beneath it at all points in between. Strange twisted glass columns rose up at irregular intervals, looking like leafless climbing vines carved from ice. The glass ceiling of the gallery was easily 1,000 yards from end to end the long way. Beyond the great gallery, on the lower layers of the island, was the portable quarter, open-faced tiers on which the miserably destitute were allowed to set up squatters' huts and whatever shelters they could construct from cast-off materials. The trouble was that any forceful wind from the north, especially in the rainy winter, would completely rearrange the place. Perversely, the district above and immediately southeast of the portable quarter, the Savrola, was a pricey expatriate's enclave, full of foreigners with money to waste. All the best inns were there, including the one Locke and Jean were currently using for their well-heeled alternate identities. The Savrola was sealed off from the portable quarter by high stone walls, and heavily patrolled by Varrari constables and private mercenaries. By day, the great gallery was the marketplace of Tal Varrar. 1,000 merchants set up their stalls beneath it every morning, and there was room for 5,000 more, should the city ever grow so vast. Visitors rooming in the Savrola, who didn't travel by boat, were forced, by cunning coincidence, to walk across the full breadth of the market to travel to or from the Golden Steps. An east wind was up, blowing out from the mainland, across the glass islands and into the gallery. Locke and Jean's footsteps echoed in the darkness of the vast hollow space. Soft lamps on some of the glass pillars made irregular islands of light. Scraps of trash blew past their feet, and wisps of wood smoke from unseen fires. Some merchants kept family members sleeping in particularly desirable stall locations all night. And, of course, there were always vagrants from the portable quarter, seeking privacy in the shadows of the empty gallery. Patrols stomped through the gallery tiers several times each night, but there were none in sight at the moment.
"What a strange wasteland this place becomes after dark," said Jean. "I can't decide if I mislike it or if it enchants me."
"You'd probably be less inclined to enchantment if you didn't have a pair of hatchets stuffed up the back of your coat."
"Hmm."
They walked on for another few minutes. Locke rubbed his stomach and muttered to himself.
"Jean, are you hungry by chance?"
"I usually am. Need some more ballast for that liquor?"
"I think it might be a good idea. Damn that carousel. Another losing hand and I might have proposed marriage to that god's damned smoking dragoness, or just fallen out of my chair."
"Well, let's raid the night market." On the topmost tier of the great gallery, toward the northeastern end of the covered district, Locke could see the flickering light of barrel fires and lanterns, and the shadowy shapes of several people. Commerce never truly ground to a halt in Tal'Varar. With thousands of people coming and going from the Golden Steps, there was enough coin floating around for a few dozen nocturnal stallkeepers to stake out a spot just after sunset every evening. The night market could be a great convenience, and it was invariably more eccentric than its daytime counterpart. As Locke and Jean strolled toward the bazaar with the night breeze blowing against them, they had a fine view of the inner harbour with its dark forest of ships' masts. Beyond that, the rest of the city's islands lay sensibly sleeping, dotted here and there with specks of light rather than the profligate glow of the Golden Steps. At the heart of the city, the three crescent islands of the great guilds, alchemists, artificers, and merchants, curled around the base of the high, rocky Castellana like slumbering beasts. And atop the Castellana, like a looming stone hill planted in a field of mansions, was the dim outline of the Mon Magisteria, the fortress of the Archon. Tal'Varar was supposedly ruled by the Priori, but in reality a significant degree of power rested in the man who resided in that palace, the city's master of arms. The office of the Archon had been created following Tal'Varar's early disgraces in the Thousand-Day War against Camor, to take command of the army and navy out of the hands of the bickering merchant councils. But the trouble with creating military dictators, Locke reflected, was getting rid of them after the immediate crisis was past. The first Archon had declined retirement, and his successor was, if anything, even more interested in interfering with civic affairs. Outside guarded bastions of frivolity like the Golden Steps and expatriate havens like the Savrola, the disagreements between Archon and Priori kept the city on edge.
"Gentlemen,"
came a voice from their left, breaking into Locke's chain of thought.
"Honored sirs, a walk across the great gallery cannot possibly be complete without refreshment."
Locke and Jean had reached the fringes of the night market. There were no other customers in sight, and the faces of at least a dozen merchants stared keenly out at them from within their little circles of fire or lamplight. The first Varari to throw his pitch against the gates of their good judgment was a one-armed man getting on in years, with long white hair braided down to his waist. He waved a wooden ladle at them, indicating four small casks set atop a portable counter not unlike a flat-topped wheelbarrow.
"What's your fare?"
"Delicacies from the table of Yono himself, the sweetest taste the sea has to offer. Shark's eyes in brine, all fresh plucked. Crisp the shells, soft the humours, sweet the juices."
"Shark's eyes? Gods no," Locke grimaced. "Have you more common flesh, liver, gills? A gill pie would be welcome."
"Gills? Sir, gills have none of the virtues of the eyes. It is the eyes that tone the muscles, prevent cholera, and firm up a man's mechanisms for certain, marital duties."
"I have no need of any mechanism firming in that respect," said Locke, "and I'm afraid my stomach is too unsettled for the splendour of shark's eyes at just the moment."
A pity, sir. For your sake, I wish I had some bit of gill to offer you, but it's the eyes that I get, and little else. Yet I do have several types. Scythe sharks, wolf sharks, blue widower.
We must pass, friend, said Jean, as he and Locke walked on.
Fruit, worthy masters?
The next merchant along was a slender young woman comfortably ensconced in a cream-coloured frock coat several sizes too large for her. She also wore a four-cornered hat with a small alchemical globe dangling on a chain, hanging down just above her left shoulder. She stood watch over a number of woven baskets.
Alchemical fruit? Fresh hybrids? Have you ever seen the Sophia Orange of Camor? It makes its own liquor. Very sweet and powerful.
We are acquainted, said Locke, and more liquor is not what I had in mind. Anything to recommend for an unsettled stomach?
Pears, sir? The world would have no unsettled stomachs if only we were all wise enough to eat several every day.
She took up one basket, about half full, and held it up before him. Locke sifted through the pears, which seemed firm and fresh enough, and drew out three.
5 centira, said the fruit seller.
A full Valani?
Locke feigned outrage. Not if the Archon's favourite whore held them between her legs and wiggled for me. 1 centira is too much for the lot.
1 centira wouldn't buy you the stems. At least I won't lose money for 4.
It would be an act of supreme pity, said Locke, for me to give you 2. Fortunately for you, I'm bringing with largesse. The bounty is yours.
2 would be an insult to the men and women who grew those in the hot glass gardens of the Black Hands Crescent. But surely we can meet at 3.
3, said Locke with a smile. I have never been robbed in Tal Verar before, but I'm just hungry enough to allow you the honour.
He passed 2 of the pears to Jean without looking, while fumbling in one of his coat pockets for copper. When he tossed 3 coins to the fruit seller, she nodded.
A good evening to you, Master Lamora.
Locke froze and fixed his eyes on her.
I beg your pardon?
A good evening to you is all I said, worthy master.
You didn't...
Didn't what?
Nothing. Locke sighed nervously. I had a bit much to drink, is all. A fair evening to you as well.
He and Jean strolled away, and Locke took a tentative bite of his pear. It was in a fine state, neither too firm and dry nor too ripe and sticky.
Jean, he said between bites, did you hear what she said to me just now?
I'm afraid I heard nothing but the death cry of this unfortunate pair. Listen closely.
No, don't eat me, please, no.
Jean had already reduced his first pear to its core. As Locke watched, he popped this into his mouth, crunched it loudly, and swallowed it all but for the stem, which he flicked away.
13 gods, said Locke. Must you do that?
I like the cause, said Jean sulkily. All the little crunchy bits.
Goats eat the gods' damned crunchy bits.
You're not my mother.
Well, true. Your mother would be ugly.
Oh, don't give me that look. Go on, eat your other core. It's got a nice juicy pear wrapped around it.
What did the woman say?
She said... Oh, God, she said nothing. I'm tipsy, is all.
Alchemical lantern, sirs?
A bearded man held his arm out toward them. At least 6 little lanterns in ornamental gilt frames hung from it.
A pair of well-dressed gentlemen should not be without light. Only scrubs scuttle about in darkness with no way to see. You'll find no better lanterns in all the gallery, not by night or day.
Jean waved the man off while he and Locke finished their pears. Locke carelessly tossed his core over his shoulder while Jean popped his into his mouth, taking pains to ensure that Locke was watching when he did. "Hmm," he muttered with a half-full mouth. "Ambrosial. But you'll never know, you and all your fellow culinary cowards." "Gentlemen, scorpions?" That brought Locke and Jean up short. The speaker was a cloaked, bald-headed man with the coffee-coloured skin of an Okanti islander. The man was several thousand miles from home. His well-kept white teeth stood out as he smiled and bowed slightly over his wares. He stood over a dozen small wooden cages. Dark shapes could be seen moving about in several of them.
"Scorpions? Real scorpions? Live ones?"
Locke bent down to get a better look at the cages, but kept his distance.
"What on earth for?"
"Why, you must be fresh visitors here." The man's theron had a slight accent. "Many on the Sea of Brass are only too familiar with the grey rock scorpion. Can you be Carthani, Kamori?"
"Talishani," said Jean.
"These are grey rock scorpions from here?"
"From the mainland," said the merchant, "and their use is primarily, recreational."
"Recreational? Are they pets?"
"Oh no, not really. The sting, you see. The sting of the grey rock scorpion is a complex thing. First there is pain, sharp and hot, as you might expect. But after a few minutes there is a pleasant numbness, a dreamy sort of fever. It is not unlike some of the powders smoked by Jeremites. After a few stings, a body grows more